You know, the pyramids of Egypt have long baffled so many people. Just who built them? How were they built? Tonight, four special guests, four experts on the pyramids with their own theories. That's in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, first I'm going to introduce each guest tonight, and then after they're all introduced, we'll give them an opportunity to make a specific statement about their particular theory, their views on the Great Pyramid, and then we'll get into the discussion, a roundtable discussion, free-flowing. Last hour, two of the four guests will stay with us for sake of just brevity, and we'll open up the phone lines for you. Michel Barsoum, a professor of materials engineering at Drexel University in Philadelphia. He is a native of Egypt who graduated from the American University in Cairo. He received his master's degree in ceramics engineering at the University of Missouri, Rolla, and earned his Ph.D. from MIT in ceramics from the Department of Materials Science and Engineering. The results of one of his most recent studies points to the use of concrete in some parts of the construction of the Great Pyramids of Giza. My pleasure to introduce Michel Barsoum. Hello, Michel. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Thank you for coming on the program tonight. Our next guest, of course, Christopher Dunn. He's been a regular on Coast to Coast. He's an engineer with more than 35 years of experience. Dunn's Pyramid Odyssey began in 1977 when he read Peter Tompkins' book, Secrets of the Great Pyramid. His immediate reaction to the Giza Pyramid schematics was that this edifice was a gigantic machine. Discovering the purpose of this machine involved a process of reverse engineering that has taken over 24 years of research. In the process, he has published more than a dozen magazine articles. He has appeared on several national programs. Chris is also the author of the best-selling book on the pyramids called The Giza Power Plant, back on Coast to Coast. Hello, Christopher.
Hi, George. Good to be here.
Always a pleasure. Margaret Morris has been involved with research on the Egyptian pyramids since 1984, when she started her historical research at the Institute for Applied Archaeological Sciences. The organization was founded to advance worthwhile ancient technology and clarify areas of ancient history. She has debated the premise of her book, The Egyptian Pyramid Mystery is Solved, in scientific and technical journals, including the Journal of Geological Education. Her book is the product of almost 20 years of research, during which time she worked with scientists on a variety of disciplines to offer proof of the new paradigm advanced within its pages. Almost 5 years ago, Margaret, you were on the program with me. How fast time goes by, huh?
Yes, George.
Good to have you with us. And then Robert Schock, a Ph.D. in geology and geophysics from Yale. He's been working in Egypt, focusing on the Great Sphinx and the Great Pyramid since 1990. He is a tenured full-time faculty member at the College of General Studies of Boston University, where he taught a variety of science courses since 1984. Based on his geological studies, Robert has determined that the Sphinx's origins go back to the pre-dynastic times. That's thousands of years older than previously thought. In recent years, Dr. Schock has expanded his research to encompass pyramids and associated structures around the world. Hello, Robert.
Oh.
Good to have you with us.
Oh, thank you.
My pleasure. Let's start with you, Michel, if we can. We'll give you an opportunity to make an opening statement on your thoughts and your views on pyramid.
Okay. Well, I mean, about 5 years ago, I got a call out of the blue. Somebody says, you're originally from Egypt, and I said, yes. And he said, well, you're familiar with their mysteries, and I said, yes. And he listed about five or six mysteries, how you can't put a card between some of the blocks, and how you can't really get ramps all the way up to the top. And he went on like that for a while, and then he said, you know, the mystery was solved. And I said, really? No, I hadn't heard. And he said, yes, Joseph Davidovits solved the mystery in the early 80s, and he claims that the pyramids were cast. And so I started laughing, and he said, why are you laughing? I said, this is the 21st century. You know, if I can't tell the difference between a natural stone and an artificial stone, as a material scientist, I should really give him my degree back, because I don't deserve it. So he said, well, that's exactly why I'm calling you. So, you know, my curiosity was really piqued, and I started looking around for some samples. It's not easy to get 5,000-year-old samples.
No.
And then this person who called me was a friend of Margie, who's on the show. Hi, Margie. And she gave me the famous Lauer sample. I can explain Lauer, the Lauer sample in a second.
Mm-hmm.
And Davidovits, then I got in contact with Davidovits, and he gave me a few other samples from one of the satellite pyramids and a whole bunch of natural limestones from around the Giza Plateau and from across the Nile, the so-called Tura quarries. And the Tura quarries are special because supposedly the outer casing and the inner casing of the pyramids were made from the Tura quarry, but the rest of the pyramid was made from the limestone, which is on the Giza Plateau, which is right there where the pyramids are. So I started looking at those about 4.5 years ago, and I thought it was going to take me 2 weeks or maybe less. I thought, how difficult can it be? Well, it turned out to be quite a challenge. And but at the end, we think we have some very convincing, very strong evidence, microstructural evidence. That is, we looked at these samples under a microscope, and we can look at them at high magnification. We can measure their composition fairly accurately at the very local scale, you know, the order of a couple of microns. We did transmission electron microscopy to find out if these samples are amorphous or crystalline. Again, these are terms, technical terms. And we discovered that some of them are actually amorphous. In other words, they didn't have long-range order. It's like disordered chairs in a classroom, which means that they were these minerals were deposited fairly rapidly. Then you know we put this thing together, and you know of course I started looking at the whole. The whole idea, and the Egyptologists have always claimed that the entire pyramid was carved, and Joseph Davidovits and Margie have claimed that they're all cast. And I took another good look at, well, I know now that the outer casing and the inner casing are most probably not natural. Okay, so they are man-made. And so then I went and looked at the historical record, and I convinced myself that essentially the majority of the pyramids are carved, roughly, if you want to take a rough number, about 80% of it is carved stone. And then on the outside, on the inside, and the top half, roughly, the top half, again, that's speculation right now. You know, all I know is that the inside... In the inner casing and the outer casing are artificial.
All right, hold that right there, Michelle, because sure. I want to get Christopher Dunn's statement now on his thoughts. Go ahead, Christopher.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you for inviting me on the show tonight and to speak with our distinguished guests. As you mentioned earlier, my quest started in 1977, and I believe that people coming into this particular area of study or research, we have a lot of people who come from different backgrounds, and it is people from different backgrounds that I believe are necessary to unravel the mystery or the puzzle of how the pyramids were built. But I think that it demands cooperation between multidiscipline researchers in this quest for knowledge. So having said that, I will go back to 1977 when, as a manufacturer, reading the book by Peter Tompkins, Secrets of the Great Pyramid, and what he described in that book struck me as a manufacturer and somebody who's worked with precision all my life. And what struck me was the precision of this huge artifact on a scale of acres, actually unbelievable in terms of what we demand from structures today regarding the alignments
right.
of them, the how the Great Pyramid was leveled over 13 acres within 7/8 of an inch, and the precision of the casing blocks within 10,000ths of an inch or half the thickness of a thumbnail. The descending passage going down 150 feet and only varying from a straight line, the thickness of a thumbnail or 20,000ths of an inch, and then the entire passageway being cut within a quarter of an inch. It's absolutely incredible structure, and that's what struck me. Also, associated with that precision was the unusual design of the internal structure, the internal passageways and chambers and shafts that shoot off at different angles. And there's a lot of mystery associated with that. And the mystery was brought out very, very cogently by Peter Tompkins, and it did raise a huge question about the nature of the Great Pyramid, and was it truly what we have been taught in school, a tomb? And it seemed to me at that time that it was what I would consider to be the state of the art of a civilization. And there was a lot of ancillary kind of products that would have been necessary to build the Great Pyramid that are no longer around. But anyway, I tried to analyze it. There was a lot of different anomalous substances that you would find, architectural features that I had questions about, the fact that the King's Chamber had been expanded over an inch. There was evidently some force generally credited to an earthquake, which mm-hmm. didn't seem to fit for me, but because the chamber expanded rather than collapsed. And then the introduction of granite into this so-called King's Chamber. But there's a lot of mystery, a lot of questions. And so it was actually while reading the Secrets of the Great Pyramids that it occurred to me that this had the precision of a machine, only on a scale of acres. Perhaps it was a machine. And if it was, then it would be good to do a reverse engineering on it to see how it actually functions.
All right. And when we come back to you later, Christopher, we're going to talk about what you think happened to some of the machinery that you believe was used to construct this. Now let's go to you, Margaret. Let's pick up on your thoughts. Again, it's been almost 7 years since you've been on Coast to Coast, so you might want to refresh our memory with your book, The Egyptian Pyramid Mystery is Solved. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Yes, Michelle actually read my book. It's one of the pieces of evidence that helped him to begin his massive study. And some of the things that I show in that book are so highly significant to the fact that the blocks are cast. One of the problems you see when you go to Giza is the lack of evidence of actual block quarrying mm-hmm. at the site. Petrie, for instance, walked the whole site and he walked miles. And the quarries are today completely exposed, so you can see everything that went on there. And there's been a small field that everyone has pointed to where there looks like stumps from the removal of some blocks that were cut out. However, we measured that quarry to get a very rough estimate of its size. Systems engineer Mike Carroll actually did this work on behalf of this research. And Mike determined that the size of this quarry was only, the quarry sits next to Khafre's pyramid, which is the second great pyramid mm-hmm. at Giza. And the size of this quarry, which is the only place at Giza where we see any blocks removed, aside from some random holes that we know were made by the Romans because they did some restoration work. But the size of the quarry, the only place at Giza where blocks were taken, is only 3% of Khafre's pyramid.
Now, and let me ask you, if there were a huge quarry there, would sand over 5 or 10,000 years, Margaret, fill it all in by any chance?
Well, here's the problem. The quarries have been largely cleared. And so we know for Old Kingdom quarries in general, what we find all over the walls is not today, if you look at a limestone quarry, you see the use of advanced machining because they use power tools to slice down the walls. That's not what you see in Old Kingdom quarries. What you see is that somebody took a pointed pick, like a flint pick or something, and they just made random chop marks everywhere.
And you see these staggered chop marks,
yes,
right?
And this is consistent with an agglomeration, you know, just a defragmentation of rock that you can agglomerate. And that stone at Giza is very high in clay, and if you get it wet, it will come apart very easily. This is why the Sphinx is so fragile compared to the Great Pyramid, where the blocks are.
So you basically believe in a poured theory?
Yes.
Okay.
And I believe in it for the bulk of the pyramid, excluding restoration material.
All right.
And there are very good reasons for this.
All right, we'll get into that. And Robert Schock, hello, Robert. Let's talk a little bit about your thoughts.
Oh, thank you. Well, I guess as introduction, some of your audience will know that I got involved in Egypt beginning in 1990 by invitation of John Anthony West. And I started by, actually my work in Egypt really began by focusing on the Great Sphinx and looking at that from a geological point of view. I'm a geologist. My PhD is in geology and geophysics. And what I came to conclude, which remains how should I say, controversial, but more and more people accepting it. I've had very good acceptance among my fellow geologists, is that looking at the Sphinx, which I am absolutely convinced is carved from solid bedrock, so we're talking natural rock there, predates the pyramids, goes back into pre-dynastic time, based on weathering patterns. But that's another story for another day. Working on the Sphinx all those years, I also started looking at the pyramids, got very interested in the pyramids. At this point, I've been working on pyramids actually around the world, but focusing primarily on the Great Pyramid, which seems to be the topic of our discussion today.
Right.
And much discussion. Actually published a book, well, it came out in 2005 now, called Pyramid Quest, focusing on the Great Pyramid.
Okay.
And to summarize some of my thoughts on the Great Pyramid, I agree with many others, including Chris Dunn, that it's not a tomb, or certainly not primarily a tomb, even if it, I'll grant that maybe, possibly, although I don't even see evidence for it, it could have been used as a tomb secondarily or tertiarily. But one thing that I've come to conclude about the Great Pyramid is that it's actually not a single piece that was not built, in my opinion, all at one time as a single piece for a single purpose, but in fact it was built over a long period of time, over many thousands of years, built in stages effectively, and I believe was used for different purposes at different times. So that's
something. Was it complete for the moment when they did the work, you think?
Oh, I think, yeah, I think at any particular stage it was complete from their point of view.
Then somebody decided along the line, hey, let's do this to it or something.
Exactly, exactly. And I think the oldest portions of the Great Pyramid actually go back into pre-dynastic times. And when I say the Great Pyramid, it didn't look like the pyramid looks now. For instance, the earliest portions, in my opinion, are the descending passage into the bedrock going down into the subterranean chamber, which my speculation has had various ritualistic purposes, you know, purposes. Essentially, the Great Pyramid is built over a natural mound, which sometimes I've referred to as a sacred mound, and then was built up at one point. I think it was effectively a platform that may have been used for sacred, you know, services, ritualistic purposes, astronomical purposes.
All right, Robert, stay with us. All four of you, of course, stay with us. All of their respective websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com, so you'll be able to get that. We've got a pretty good graphic that Michel Barsoom sent us as well with his theory of the poured theory. Graham Hancock wanted to be on the show, but he could not make it tonight. Of course, Graham has his own theories as well. What happened? How was it built? Who built it? I'll be back in a moment. Okay, now with the introductions out of the way, let's get right into the meat of the program tonight as we talk about just who built them, how were they built, with the various theories that we have here. Michelle, let me ask you first and foremost, the technology that you believe was used to build the Great Pyramid, do you think it was sophisticated technology, technology that somehow has been lost or left the planet, wherever it may be, or do you think it was pretty simple?
I think it was fairly sophisticated because we looked at three different stones from the pyramids and we got four different recipes. So in that sense, it was very sophisticated. They knew what they were doing and they had, again, there's more work needs to be done, but they understood what the different layers. I mean, in one case, in the inner casing layer, the lower sample, there's an outside, there is the calcium carbonate or the limestone, or the synthetic limestone is the bulk of the sample. And on the outside of that, there's a thin layer of calcium phosphate, basically bones. I don't know where they got the bones.
Huh.
But and then on top of that, there's an iron-based paint. So we're not talking, we're talking sophisticated here. I mean, this is not, I mean, you know, I'm not saying that all the other, and the other blocks are all the same.
But right.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was very sophisticated. But I think what's more impressive to me, much more than sophistication, is the longevity of it.
Okay.
I mean, the fact that that an artificial stone would last for 4,500 years is just astounding.
Christopher, what about, you know, the extraterrestrial theory that we've heard in the past? I mean, is that something that we can just sweep away and just say, no, that is not the case?
Yes, I believe so.
All right.
I do not believe, I don't think there's any evidence to even speculate on that.
The technology that you were talking about that may have built this possible machine, how sophisticated do you believe it might have been?
Well, incredibly sophisticated equipment. The evidence that I have looked at and measured, and for those who have internet access, they can go to my website and click on that link at the top to look at these artifacts that are on the Giza Plateau. And essentially what I have found is evidence of machining technologies that we would be hard-pressed to match even today. And the scope of the work is, for a modern engineer, is humbling. To go to Egypt and to actually look at what they accomplished, to provide just a simplistic answer to the nature of this civilization, I think does the Egyptians a disservice. They were certainly much further ahead than the Greeks or the Romans in what they were doing. I believe a lot of the artifacts have been misinterpreted, but when it actually comes down to doing, actually performing the work, and as you scroll down, you will see different exhibits where, and actually touching on the geopolymer theory, if you look at Exhibit 5, I'm not sure Robert may be able to add some voice to that, but it does look like they may have been employing both cutting methods and also pouring methods. And what I say in my book is that I don't think that the cutting or pouring are mutually exclusive theories. Or I think you can, I mean, if you go to any building site today, you'll see all kinds of methods being applied to do the most efficient job.
What do you think, Christopher, happened to this incredible knowledge that they possessed? It seems like it died off. It went away. What happened to it?
What I believe, what I've got, I've come to the realization, is that, and let me preface what I'm going to say by saying that today we have no problem in an abstract way believing and talking about a massive cataclysm hitting the planet and in the future.
Right.
Because, I mean, we look at the tsunami, and the tsunamis that are potentially going to happen. It's not a matter of if, it's just when.
When, sure.
And then the near-Earth objects that could be possibly hit the planet. That discussion is ongoing, and there seems to be quite a fascination for it. But there is that aspect. We have no problem with intellectualizing that. We have no problem with accepting the fact that these events have visited the planet in the past. What we do have a problem with, I believe, is to think that a civilization had reached such a high level, similar to ours, maybe not exactly the same,
but close.
They had developed technologies,
yeah,
and that this civilization had been reduced to rubble. Or to, you know, just a few thousand people.
Mm-hmm.
And there is evidence, but you have to push the chronology back further than the old kingdom to really find the events that would actually be that cataclysmic. So I believe that, yeah, I mean, we think about our civilization and how mortal our civilization is. We could be taken out in the blink of an eye, and the survivors, if there are any, will be left to start over.
Well, and I've got to tell you, Christopher, if something happened where the people who know how to generate electrical power for us and the grid was knocked out, I don't know how to do that. So it would be, in my particular case, I'd be in the Dark Ages.
Well, you would. And,
yeah,
and I am in the power industry. We create products for power generation, not just for flight hardware, but stationary power. And the elements or the materials that we use in our products are nickel, cobalt, and the material science, just the extraction technology and the foundry technology that goes into creating these exotic alloys that go into these products. You just take out one aspect or one arm of that chain, the supply chain, and everything will just fall apart.
Okay, go ahead, Christopher, finish up.
And if you don't have, you know, if you don't have the skills and the knowledge to build it back again, then what are you going to do? What am I going to do? If I can't get materials, I don't know how to extract the elements necessary or smelt them into the materials, the rolling mills that we use. So yeah, it would be a huge cataclysm, devastating situation.
Now, Margaret, if the port theory is correct, Michel believes, of course, that a portion of it may have been poured, the rest quarried. How about you? Do you think the whole thing was poured?
Yes, I think that everything was poured except for later restoration blocks. And one of the reasons I believe that, well, there's two good reasons. First of all, there were electromagnetic sounding studies done on the Great Pyramid, and they failed because of moisture content throughout the two pyramids that were tested, which was Khufu and Khafre. And so Dr. Edward J. Zeller of the University of Kansas evaluated all of the data, and he also checked with the weather reports to see if this water could be accounted for
right
environmentally. And all of the data supported the fact that, well, Giza was extremely dry. There was no measurable rainfall for 6 months before the tests were done. And he concluded that the data is consistent with hydraulic cement, which contains chemically bound water, whereas natural limestone does not.
How long would it take to dry one of the blocks, let's say?
Well, this water is molecularly bound. It always stays in there. This is the difference between natural limestone and what Joseph Davidovits makes. You need a very sophisticated test, like Michelle uses, to tell that it isn't natural limestone. But one of the characteristics is that every hydraulic concrete will contain chemically bound water. Natural limestone does not. So this is one line of evidence suggesting that the bulk of both the pyramids tested is synthetic stone. Another thing is that, as I say, there is not enough evidence of whole block quarrying at Giza. And the only other pneumolytic limestone bed in Egypt is way in Middle Egypt. And it wouldn't make sense to transport rock from Middle Egypt when there's high-quality limestone at Giza that is left untouched. So also, if the blocks were largely caught, the quarries would have to be much larger than they are, because they've been measured. Well, the one associated with Khufu is roughly the size of Khufu. This will happen with concrete because there's no waste. Whereas when you cut blocks, you have a real problem because all of the tier heights conform to only 75 sizes. So you have to do very precision cutting. And the tiers were measured, and their heights were rounded off within a half a centimeter, which means extreme levelness.
Now tell me about the cement molds that they would have, Margaret, in order to create the pouring of the blocks.
Well, there's different ways that you can do this. Remember that Egypt's oldest building material was adobe. So they took adobe construction methods and they adapted them for this kind of material,
right,
for synthetic stone. So they're not using the sort of things that we use today. They were using primitive methods,
sure,
at their disposal. Petrie hunted through the garbage dumps at Giza. He found no evidence of anything except for late Stone Age technology at Giza. He found nothing suggestive of high tech at all. But if anyone wants to go to Joseph Davidovits's website, which is www.geopolymer.org, they can see a wonderful film where the Geopolymer Institute made imitation pyramid stone, averaging about 6 tons. And now Davidovits used wooden molds, but it's not necessary to do things that way.
All right, and feel free, the rest of you, to jump in at any time.
I was going to say that movie is also on my website.
Okay.
Yeah, and Michelle has a good blog that people can look at. Michelle, you should give
all
us
right.
a...
And let's go, Robert, let me ask you one quick question about the Sphinx, if I can, then we'll get back to the pyramid. Are you a believer in Edgar Cayce's theory that there's something, a hall of records at the foot of the Sphinx somewhere, some kind of huge chamber?
Okay, here's my quick comment. I don't mean to be totally facetious. I'm a scientist, so I'm not a believer in anything in that sense. But I try to keep an open mind on everything and look at evidence. And the evidence is that Tom DeBecky and myself in the early 1990s did seismic work, geophysical work around the Sphinx, and we found, sure enough, you could call it a chamber, a cavity, under the left paw of the Sphinx.
How big do you think it is?
Oh, it's fairly big. I mean, you're talking, 10 meters or more.
And how deep?
I really want to go back there and do more geophysics, but that's another issue for another day. Probably at least 5 to 10 meters deep.
Oh my God.
Below the surface.
And Zahi is not digging that up yet?
No. We've talked about this, had a lot of back and forth. Eventually, I think I'll get in there.
Oh,
someone will get in there.
Well, you know what? I've been a believer in Edgar Cayce, but you're, like you said, you're the scientist. But
to be honest with you, DeBecky and I found that I'll call it a chamber. I believe it's a chamber essentially under the left paw and a bit in front of the left paw. It goes probably extends under the Sphinx temple.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and I knew nothing about Edgar Cayce's prediction. I mean, I'd heard of Edgar Cayce before, but I didn't know about his prediction. We published that. Next thing I know, I'm getting phone calls. Edgar Cayce had predicted.
Well, if you go there,
I found it.
If you go there and you dig that up, you got to let us know what's in it. See, part of me thinks that Zahi has already uncovered it.
A lot of people speculate on that.
You think that's possible?
Well, I don't think it's possible yet. I think that the entrance to that chamber will be found in front of the Sphinx Temple. The Sphinx Temple sits east of the Great Sphinx. The Sphinx faces east, so in front of the pause is the Sphinx Temple, what's known as the Sphinx Temple. And what we found seismically is that what in the 90s was nothing but a flat, sandy area in east of the Sphinx Temple actually is a lot of sand there, and when you look at seismically, there's a natural cliff that drops down. So essentially the Sphinx and Sphinx Temple sat on a cliff, which is now buried in sand.
Amazing. Whole show by itself, Robert. We'll get you back for this, okay?
Sure.
We'll do that. But let's get back to the Sphinx. And specifically, are you a believer, too, then, in the Pord theory, basically?
No.
Okay.
Okay, let me tell you what I'm not a believer in anything. I just said that. What I think we've got here is a situation where we really need to look at the evidence very carefully. I think Michelle has, I read his paper, put together some very interesting evidence, which goes a much further, in my opinion. This is not to belittle anyone, but than Joseph Dvizovitz did, as far as making a case that some of these samples that have been analyzed do seem to be or have evidence of not being natural, that they could be artificial. And where I think we have to go now is really go back to the Giza Plateau, go back to Egypt. And what I am frustrated with at the moment, and I don't mean frustrated in the kind of nasty sense, but frustrated that we don't have the sample suites that I really think we need to analyze this carefully. There's a lot of speculation, I think, based on simply a gross analysis. And what I mean by that is looking at the rocks in the field, and I'll use the term rocks right now.
All right.
There's a lot of rocks in the Giza Plateau. I've spent a lot of time in the Great Pyramid. I was just there last month again. And I, as a geologist, recognize most of the rock in the Great Pyramid, and I'm using my words carefully, as natural rock. I mean, that's my first impression, first opinion, and that doesn't preclude, in my opinion, that some of it could be artificial, that they were using artificial. I don't, and I said this 15 years ago, I don't buy what I'll call the strong Dvizovitz-Morris theory that they're 100% or close to 100%.
Right. Okay. Now, if your thoughts are correct, Robert, what's the method of moving these huge blocks?
Now, I don't have a good answer to that, because this is a real problem, and this gets into the whole issue of the technology and the sophisticated technology that was being used. And I think either way, if you're moving, if you're quarrying and moving huge natural stone blocks, that there's a incredibly sophisticated technology, especially with the amount that was moved. The, you know, in some cases you're talking 70-ton blocks. The tolerances are incredible, as Chris Dunn was just mentioning. Also, just to move them into position, there's not much room to be maneuvering.
All right, let's get all of you involved in the technology when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And also incredible, Robert Schock telling us that several years ago he and his colleague did find seismically a large chamber near the Sphinx. And Edgar Cayce predicted that that would be found 50, 60 years ago. That's incredible. But what's in it? Well, we'll get Robert back for a complete show. In the meantime, special guests Christopher Dunn, Michelle Barsoom, Robert Schock, and Margaret Morris, and I will be back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. With you, Christopher, let's start by asking you this about clues out there that would make you so sure that these artifacts have been machined.
Sure. First of all, what I would like to say is that You know, in today's world, we have different classes of work. You talk to a quarry person, somebody working in a quarry, and as far as tolerances on a product or a block of stone, they would work to within a quarter of an inch, maybe a little closer. That's one class of work. You get into manufacturing, and you have production operators, and they may work to within 5/1000ths of an inch, a quarter of the thickness of a thumbnail. Then that is another class of work. Then you would get into precision machining, which those machinists would work to within 1/1000ths of an inch, about half, less than half the thickness of a human hair. And then you get into even more precise work. Then you're talking about precision tool makers, gauge makers, opticians, and lapidary work. They work to within 1/10000ths of an inch, so a tenth of what the machinist would work to. Now, having said that, I'm setting the stage to describe what we do have in Egypt on the Giza Plateau and in other areas around Egypt, particularly in the Serapeum. And what we have are objects that show a geometry, a perfection of geometry, and a tolerance on the cut stone to within 2/10000ths of an inch.
That's incredible.
And yes, that's 1/10 the thickness of a human hair.
I'm not sure we could do that today.
Well, we can do that today. I mean, we understand. I mean, we do it all the time. And if we had to create some of these granite blocks that are machined to such close tolerances, we could devise the equipment to do it.
Could we have done it 200 years ago?
Well, actually, the concept of precision really didn't come into play until the Industrial Revolution,
right,
in terms of these kind of geometries, flat surfaces within 2/10000ths of an inch that you will see on my website. On that page, if you scroll down, the very bottom there shows me inside this granite box inside the Serapeum, and the toolmaker's square that I'm using has a 14-inch blade, and and is precise to within 50 millionths of an inch. And the match or the light that you would see if there was any deviation from perfection on the blocks is not there. You don't see any light coming through the interface. And not only that, if you look at the underside of the lid, you will see a reflection of my hand, and you also see a reflection of the square that I'm using. And that is indicative of a perfectly flat surface. And not only just in those places that you see me measuring them, but also across the entire length of the box. Now, when we look at this and we say, this was quarried as a single piece and cored out of a single block, and then finished off to that kind of precision, something's going on here that is not consistent with what we're being told about the purpose for these things. We would not perform that kind of work for just simple purposes. Number one, the concept of precision, as I said, didn't come into bear until the Industrial Revolution. And that was only because we found a need for it. We found a need to reduce the variables in the processes to create more precise artifacts. In fact, if you go back to the Civil War, they started to realize that they needed to reduce the variables in the manufacturing process because they didn't want their soldiers modifying the spare parts that were going out into the field because
right,
they were having to file them down to make them fit. And so if you go back into our recent history and you see what kind of work was being performed then, and then you go into Egypt and you see these artifacts that are more indicative of modern precision. That's why I say is that the high tech is there. It is cut into the stone. It is certainly secondary evidence or circumstantial evidence, but it is not possible to create these with anything but very, very precise instruments.
Okay.
And we're not even talking about how they lifted these blocks. Because
right. That's another issue.
That's a totally other issue. That lid weighs over 20 tons.
And you believe, though, some catastrophe wiped them out, Christopher?
I believe that that's the case. I believe the evidence is in the geological record, the biological record, to show that there was indeed a huge catastrophe.
Could it have been nuclear, that they blew themselves up in some kind of battle or war?
Well, I wrote about that in my book, and I'm not really convinced that that is the real answer. I think there are numerous possibilities. I'm not really stuck on one. I mean, just recently, last year, they discovered this crater in southern Egypt, and the crater was only visible from space, and it was 19 miles in diameter. Now, we don't know what the age of that, that meteor strike is, but certainly that does really put a different light on catastrophism.
Sure does. Michel Barsoom, let's go back to you again, being an expert in ceramics and your theory of partial concrete in the rest block stone. They did polish it up, right? They polished the pyramid up on the sides with some kind of liquid-type limestone, didn't they? Didn't they make it smooth?
Well, that's what is called the outer casing.
Right.
Okay. I mean, in other words, the pyramids now, except for the second pyramid that has a little bit of its casing still at the very top.
So I think almost everyone will accept the theory that that occurred, right?
Well, no, actually, no. The Egyptologists do not concede even that point.
Right. They don't say that it was like a smooth, nice...
Oh, no. Yes, it was smooth. Yeah. What I'm saying is that outer smooth stone was cast.
I agree. And then, so what? Some of the Egyptologists say that there was no casting done at all?
At all, yeah.
I see. Let's get into the science of the casting for a moment, if you could.
Okay. Yeah, I can... It's a very simple formula in retrospect. What I think they did is they started with something called diatomaceous earth.
Okay.
Which is, you can go buy it for your pool filter.
It's that white stuff, that real powdery stuff.
Right.
Okay.
That's the stuff, right? And it's basically amorphous silica or amorphous sand.
Okay.
Okay. So you, that's one ingredient. What you need is water. You add lime to the water.
All right.
Okay, and then you add your diatomaceous earth. And the high pH of the lime, basically it's an alkali solution.
Mm-hmm.
And what that does, it dissolves that very fine diatomaceous earth. And then you dump in your limestone rubble. And then you wait a few days. The water evaporates. And this is from the bit of its idea.
So the rubble is to give it more mass, I guess?
Well, no, actually the rubble is the main ingredient. It's like concrete. Like concrete, you have both the cement, the Portland cement.
And little stones. And
the aggregate, essentially.
Okay, I'm with you.
So the limestone is the aggregate in this case. And then you let the water evaporate for a few days, and you end up with a mud, kind of a dryish mud.
All right.
And then you make a bucket brigade. And you pass the mud, again, this is the bit of its work, and you pass it along from one person to the other.
All the way.
All the way to the very top. And then you cast it in a wooden mold, and you tamp it down, and there you go.
Well, not to the top. They start on the bottom first, right?
Well, of course, right.
And so they do the perimeter, they just keep going up?
Yeah, well, the exact details I do not. I haven't really thought about it. I just want to say one
right.
point about why it would be very difficult to cast the whole thing. and that came out of our study. Basically, what made the water alkaline is limes. And to make lime from limestone, you need to go to 900 degrees C. And that's a very high temperature for a primitive society. If you're going to just burn wood, it's not easy to get 900 degrees C. And one of the valid criticisms to Joseph Davidovits' theory was that there were not enough trees in Africa, and I'm exaggerating now,
right,
to make enough lime to make enough cement. And this is part of the fact that if you go to this hybrid model, then, in other words, for them, in my opinion, it was more expensive, quote-unquote expensive, to cast than to actually carve and haul up.
All right. And Margaret Morris, why do you believe the entire structure was cast?
First of all, as I say, the evidence for block quarrying does not exist at Giza to support the Great Pyramid. The quarry would have to be many times larger to support the Great Pyramid. I go into quite a bit of detail.
I mean, are there any quarries in Egypt, even if they're hundreds of miles away?
There's one other Nummulitic limestone quarry in Middle Egypt. You would have to ferry all those blocks from afar, and you would have to leave good limestone at the foot of the pyramid and all over Giza untouched. It doesn't make sense. But what we propose is that in the beginning of the Egyptian civilization, when they were building their first towns, they had to do massive deforestation. They had to get rid of that wood cover so they could get away from the wild animals and start to farm. And we think that in the early dynasties, they had a lot of wood. They burned it. They made lime with it. And even lime from cooking pots, if it were saved and given over to the government for...
Yeah, we don't have that evidence, Margie, because that may be true of other blocks, but from the blocks we looked at, there was no sodium and no potassium.
Okay. Well, all I can say is that we have to get more samples, but everything we see, for instance, Dr. Sock said that when he went to Giza and he looked at it with his naked eye, it looks like limestone. The reason for this is because geopolymerization produces such tiny cement particles that they cannot be seen with the naked eye. You have to have a scanning electron microscope to even see them. So the limestone is going to look natural. And, of course, you know that we've had a problem for 20 years that Egyptology has not been open to any alternative ideas about the pyramids, so we were denied samples.
Right.
So what we did to overcome this was to go out in the field and look for telltale blocks. For instance, we have a photograph of a block on Khafre's pyramid, and it's got just a huge cobble in it.
If you were able to analyze a block, you'd probably know right away, wouldn't you?
Well, sometimes you don't have to analyze. Sometimes you can just look, because sometimes there are telltale features.
Yeah.
I'm talking about a block that I've shown to limestone geologists, and they all say, well, this is impossible within the natural formation.
Well, aren't there some fossils in some of the blocks?
Yes.
How'd they get there?
First of all, the rubble from the Giza quarry is a Nummulitic limestone. It's full of these fossil shells they can be up to the size of a quarter. That stuff was gathered up and it was converted into concrete. So when you go to Giza and you inspect quarries, what you largely see is normal sedimentary layering where the little fossils look like coins.
They were just flat. Mixed in, you're saying?
Yeah, they're just flat. Where the little animals died, they just lie flat. But when you go to the pyramids and the monuments, not the Sphinx, because the Sphinx is just a leftover from excavating the concrete grade limestone. But when you look at the monuments that are masonry blocks, what you find is that the shells are all scrambled up, as they would be in any kind of concrete. There are only very few, I think we've found two areas at Giza where the shells are not all jumbled up, and those two areas are places where it is known that they took advantage of the natural bedrock in order to save themselves labor when they built
it. Interesting. Now, Christopher, in your book, The Giza Power Plant, you talk about Coral Castle and Edward Leeds Scullin. And a couple of years ago, Richard C. Hoagland went down to Homestead, Florida, to do his own investigation there. I found that interesting that you would mention him in that book.
Yeah, and the reason I did that is, obviously, it's Coral Castle is not in Egypt, and it's not related to the ancient Egyptians. But the reason I included it in the book was that when it comes to analyzing or theorizing about how the ancient Egyptians lifted stone, we have lots of candidates who are, you know, on television, on documentaries, theorizing this and that. And Ed Leeds Scullin seemed to me to be the only person who actually demonstrated it. He stated specifically that he knew the secrets of how the pyramids were built. And then this 100-pound man, soaking wet, was able to lift into place 30-ton rocks of stone.
Exactly. I mean, it's very puzzling. And
so that's a huge mystery. And, you know, I don't know that nobody knows the answer.
Now, he was an expert in magnetics, and he was an expert in sounds. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if there's a tie-in there.
Well, I think so. I think he had something. Can I prove it? No. I mean, it's just a hunch. But then a lot of us work off of hunches. But I think that he definitely had something, and he was able to demonstrate it. And I don't know why he would say that he knew the secrets of how the pyramids were built, because I think to know that, you would have to go back in time to the time when they were being built. But that's what he stated.
In spite of everybody's theory, and let me very quickly just ask real quickly of the four of you, starting with you, Christopher. Regardless of your theory, are you baffled?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Regardless of my theory, it's definitely, I would put my theory aside to know the truth. I mean, this is not an ego thing for me. I am a seeker of truth, and I think that, you know, that all theories should be entertained, or at least some of the more reasonable ones. But I think it's a huge question mark. And until we answer it, it's you know, that we're missing a lot from our heritage. The ancient Egyptian heritage is missing a lot, and that needs to be restored, I think, the status in the world.
Robert Schock, how about you? You baffled?
Yeah, I'm definitely baffled. I think that's what keeps bringing people back to Egypt and back to the Giza pyramids in particular. We don't know everything. I would like to interject, if I could, very quickly. I think one of the real problems, from my point of view as a geologist, is our inability to sample so far. I mean, I think that we could solve a lot of these questions pretty easily if one was given free rein to...
I agree. There's for some reason, Zahi Hawass, who has the power to let everybody in, all of you, at one time, as a matter of fact. He won't do it, and I don't understand why. We'll talk about that. We've got a break coming up. Let's talk a little bit about why you all believe Zahi is holding back. I mean, there's something strange going on here. And Robert, like I said, we're going to work on a program with you and the Sphinx. I also think, with your permission, if we get somebody from Edgar Cayce's Foundation just to talk a little bit about what Edgar said and then tie that into your scientific investigation. I think the two of you will find out that there could be something very incredible here. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment with Christopher Dunn, Michel Barsoom, Robert Schock, and Margaret Morris. At the top of the hour, we'll keep two of them for your phone calls. I tell you, our four guests tonight, great information. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about Zahi Hawass and why they believe that he's holding back. And then, you know, why do we really need to find out how the pyramids were built? Why? We'll find out about that, too. We'll go around the table, beginning with you, Margaret Morris. Why do you think Zahi Hawass, who heads up antiquities there in Egypt, just doesn't let all of you in there to finish the job?
I think that he's following standard protocol, which is that since the days of Eric von Daniken and other and Ville Hukowski, archaeology and Egyptology have been very resistant to anything alternative about the pyramids, especially. Some of the theories get wilder every year, so they just shun it. And if Zahi Hawass understood that he could have his capstone he dreams of, and that he could have monument restoration. Zahi just doesn't know the facts. You see, Zahi, when Michel released his study, Zahi thought that Michel had accidentally taken some modern concrete restoration off the Great Pyramid. And so this shows that after 20 years, Zahi still doesn't understand the nature of a geopolymeric rock. He doesn't understand that it is real rock. It's a similar geosynthesis went on to produce 55% of the Earth's crust. So he doesn't understand this high-quality, sophisticated concrete. If he did, he would embrace this technology. I think that with 20 years of good science and Michelle's energy and 4.5 years of research, that Egyptology really is on the verge of accepting this and embracing it and using it to keep monuments from falling apart.
Michelle? How about you? Why do you think Zahi is holding back?
That's a good question. I think part of it may be not invented here. I also think that it's part of his character in terms of control.
Is he afraid that we will say that the Egyptians didn't do this?
I would think more that it somehow takes away from the monument, if you will. You know, if you can show that, I mean, you know, what would you rather have? You know, a concrete floor or a piece of granite? And I think. I don't know. I mean, I really don't quite understand it.
It is a puzzle.
Maybe you should invite him into your program.
Yeah, I think we
and
should.
And ask
we
him
should.
That question.
We should. How about you, Robert, your take?
I think Zahi, I don't think we want to underestimate his intelligence or his savvy. I mean, he is an Egyptian politician when it comes right down to it, and he's very, very knowledgeable, very savvy when it comes to Egyptian politics. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that he has a very high government official minister or close to a ministry.
Mm-hmm.
And it really has a lot to do with politics. And he's got many things to juggle at the moment. And he doesn't particularly, I believe, he probably does not want to open up certain cans of worms, which could backfire on him.
Jeopardize his career,
that type of thing. And I've had many conversations with him, both publicly and privately, and I'm not going to divulge private comments.
I understand. Do you like him as a person?
I do like him as a person. I also, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but I'll use the term, I also fear him as a person in the sense that he's a very powerful, very charismatic person.
Oh, yeah.
And one has to be, I think, hold him in high respect. And, you know, he's a very complex person.
And lastly, you, Christopher, why?
Well, I agree with Robert and Margie on their assessment of it. I would like to add, too, and Dr. Barsoom could agree or disagree, but I think that there has been a history in Egypt of outsiders coming in and tearing off with their relics. They end up in museums across the world, and I believe they're very sensitive to that. Now, the modern day archaeologist or researcher have shown that they would go in and try and rip the heritage of Egypt away from the Egyptians and assign it to Atlanteans or the aliens or other cultures, and I believe they're very sensitive about that. So I think there, you know, there's a lot of sensitivity about what has happened in the past and what they fear may happen if the door is thrown open for just anybody to go in there and start digging and develop theories. And they like to control. He likes to control information that is released. I've personally met Zahi on three occasions, and like Robert said, he's very charismatic, a very powerful man.
Well, I mean, when we were watching him on the Fox television special, remember years ago when they sent the little camera down that tunnel? Mm-hmm. I mean, he made you think that we were going to find all kinds of great things on the other side. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's a good motivator. I mean, he's exciting to listen to.
He's done a lot, including people like Robert Schock and John West and Graham Hancock. He's done a lot for tourism in Egypt.
Absolutely, absolutely. Margaret, in Baalbek, Lebanon, there's a 1,000-plus ton structure, 72 feet long. They call it the monolith. This slab is, I think, the known largest piece of you know, rock on the face of the earth. Did they pour that? How did that get there?
I think you're going to find that this technology spread around the world, and one of our goals is to find out where and to follow that trail. But I can tell you that there were larger monuments than that in ancient Egypt. The largest one that I know of that was reported in history, it doesn't exist anymore, but Pliny reported a 5,000-ton monolithic temple all the way up north in the delta at a little town of Buto, and he measured it himself, and he knew that it was monolithic. And when his measurements were analyzed by Egyptologist John Wilkinson estimated that the temple would weigh 5,000 tons, and that is based on the average weight, the average density of granite. And, of course, today we cannot duplicate the feat of taking a 5,000-ton monolith from Aswan to Buto. The closest thing that has been done in modern times was in 1996. Some engineers said it would be impossible to move a lighthouse in North Carolina to keep it away from the Atlantic Ocean that was about to take it under. And they had to do enormous technology, and they did manage to move it on a level track for a half a mile. Compare putting the same weight on a barge and moving it both overland and hundreds of miles along the Nile on a barge in ancient Egypt. We know a lot about ancient Egyptian ships. They were not strong enough. And there's no canal at Giza for getting a weight like that out. There's no dry dock. We can't say, but the most logical solution is that thing was made by the bucketful.
All right, let's go around the table. You know, we've talked about the theories on how you think this was built. Let's talk about the why it was built. Starting with you, Christopher, of course, you believe it was a basically a power plant. How would it work? What did it generate?
Well, the power plant theory actually analyzes all the evidence within the Great Pyramid. And the theory that finds answers for those features. And essentially what we have is a structure that is coupled in a resonant fashion with the Earth and vibrates in sympathy with the Earth. It's probably the prime purpose for it before the Great Pyramid, the other pyramids, when they were built, was to relieve the plates, the earthquake, earthquakes. And there has been some research done by the Russians where if you drive or cause vibration in a shaft, filled with water, they set off explosions. They can cause those plates to actually move. And there's also been some speculation, though I'm not sure if anything's been done in the United States, but there's been speculation that if you set off a series of very, very small earthquakes, you could, instead of the pressure building up to a huge release,
huge one, right.
Then you could release that energy over time. So essentially, that is basically where the energy comes from.
Was it strategically placed where it is, Christopher, or was that just random?
No, I don't think anything was random with the building of the structures
okay.
in Egypt. Nothing was random. And, I think that everything was planned ahead of time. And with all due respect to Robert, I do believe that the Great Pyramid was planned completely and constructed at one time. But that's, we all have
you all have your own
ideas
theories.
And theories, right?
And that's what makes this an exciting show. Robert? Why was it built?
Well, as I was saying before, I think there's a number of reasons, but I would say that the overarching reason was what we might term nowadays as religious or sacred. That was really a sacred structure, which doesn't preclude other things as a subcategories. For instance, astronomical observations, I think, were taken from the Great Pyramid. A lot of work has shown that it clearly has astronomical alignments, seems to fit into a larger complex at Giza. Also, tying in with what Chris Dunn was just saying, it may have in part been a response to catastrophes. And to my way of thinking, a lot of religious impulses actually tie in with nature and what's seen in the natural world, including catastrophic events. I talk about this in some of my work, including extraterrestrial catastrophes such as cometary events,
mm-hmm.
asteroids, bolides, that type of thing. And Chris was just mentioning earthquakes that might tie in also. But I see it as primarily a religious type of structure.
Okay, how about you, Michelle?
I'm not qualified to answer that question. I don't know. I mean, the only thing I know is...
Maybe just a tourist attraction. I go back and forth
right.
between L.A. and St. Louis. They've got this huge arch there. Other than a tourist attraction, I don't think it serves much of a purpose. Unless
croquet. Yeah, the only thing I could tell you is, in this particular case, I'll have to defer to the experts.
Okay, and how about you, Margaret, then?
I think that it suits the model that Egyptology has really refined, and therefore it was built by the Heliopolitan priests who were astronomers. They were very highly skilled in astronomy, and it did serve a religious sacred purpose, as Dr. Schock points out. It was... Henry Breasted, back in the early century, last century, developed the model of the primordial mountain, which was in mythology the first place to rise at the beginning of the earth. And the mythology held that the sun god lighted on the tip, let out as a sacred benben bird, which the Greeks called the phoenix, let out a cry that spun all of nature into motion, including the heavens. And that this represented the soul of the king, and that the pyramids were the dissension point, the king's soul ascended from the upper chamber of the pyramid, and the belief in ancient Egypt, too, was that the king's soul could return in times of national emergency and use the tomb as his base of operation. This was a spiritual belief. You find it throughout ancient Egyptian literature. So the pyramids fit with this model. They're in the necropolis, which is the place of tombs. They have sarcophagus in them. Each one has a sarcophagus in them. Usually we find that they were unused, so they could have been there for ritual purposes. But I think that to say that the pyramids are tombs is to reduce the idea down to the most simple, and it becomes so simple that it doesn't work. It was more complex.
Isn't it amazing, though, Margaret, here we are, whether these were built 5,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago, or even farther back, we're still perplexed by this. We're still puzzled exactly how they were built, how they were moved, what they're there for. It's amazing, isn't it?
I think that we could get to exactly how they were built if we got cooperation. We've done all of this at our own expense, on our own time, for 20 years. Michelle volunteers his time. Every scientist who has been involved in this volunteers his time because there's no actual grant money and there's no permission to really study. So this is why it takes a lifetime, and we'll probably be at it for another 20 years.
Isn't this one of the last wonders of the world?
It was the first wonder. It was proclaimed by the Greeks to be the first and foremost wonder of the ancient world.
And it's still there.
And it's still there because it's built in such a solid way. And the reason it's so solid is because the tiers are level. And this speaks to the kind of precision that you can only get with concrete construction.
It is amazing.
From a materials point of view, to me, the pyramids are child's play compared to what they could do with hard stone. That just with supposedly copper is from a material scientist's point of view, borders on the impossible. If you look at the outer casing in the Menkara pyramid, the third pyramid, there's a granite, outer casing there. And the precision and the way that these things were cut is like they were cutting cardboard. It's just amazing.
Yeah, it truly is. What happened to them, as Christopher says, perhaps a calamity, as Robert talks about. I wonder what happened to them. Something tragic occurred a long time ago.
Mm-hmm. I have to also say here that it's not that difficult to lose technology. It happens all the time, especially in Egyptian ancient history.
Could the pyramids be 50,000 years old?
Well, I don't know.
Who wants to jump in on that?
I do.
All right.
There was a mortar dating test that was done. And the dates didn't vary more than 400 years from the Fourth Dynasty, and that deviation can be accounted for because of the way the mortar was made. It had lime in it. They didn't know that, and so they had lime pollution in their test. So according to the mortar dating tests and the slight variation, the Great Pyramid is Fourth Dynasty. As
I read somewhere that they did the carbon dating on the boat that was buried, and that it was 900 years before the pyramid.
We think so that they may have preserved those boats with wood preservation techniques, and that if they geopolymerize those boats, which you can do with wood, by the way, you can soak it and kind of petrify it.
But I'm talking about the carbon dating of it.
Okay, well, all of you just stay on hold because Tommy will get to all of you. I'm going to keep two of you for phone calls, and then the rest, the other two of you, thank you so very much for being on Coast to Coast. All your websites are located, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. So we'll be back with two of our guests. I want to thank right now, of course, Michelle Barsoom, Christopher Dunn, Margaret Morris, and Robert Schock. Two of them will stay with us. We'll take phone calls next hour for you right here on Coast to Coast AM. And if you need to email me about anything, well, all you simply have to do is go to george@coasttocoastam.com. We'll be right back in just a moment with two of our guests remaining, four came in to go out, and your phone calls. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast with Christopher Dunn staying with us, Robert Schock, and your phone calls. It is a fascinating field, both of you, Christopher and Robert. I envy you in part because I've never been in that region of the world. Robert, my father was born in Cairo.
Oh, really? Wow.
In 1923, and they stayed there 6 years before they came to the United States. And they were touring all over the place, and that's where he was, and boom, out he came.
And you've never been to Egypt?
I have never been to Egypt.
Oh, you have to go.
I would like to go. You know, I wouldn't mind going. You know, maybe if we set up a group with all of us and do some live coast-to-coast shows there.
Oh, that would be great.
That would be awesome. I would love to be out in the field with Robert, too.
Yeah, that would be
last
wonderful.
Last year, I went with John Anthony West in February. And we had obviously, we don't all agree, we don't all agree about the same thing. And we have different thoughts about the purpose for the pyramid, but we're a lot closer, I believe, than what a lot of people think.
I agree.
I know that Robert does not necessarily agree with the power plant theory, but I know in his book he did mention that he did think it was a large musical instrument, or it acted like a large musical instrument.
Exactly.
Which is exactly what I said in my book, that it was a huge musical instrument. So, and, you know, the spiritual aspects of it, I don't see that we're too far apart in a lot of things. And I know that the science within the pyramid is a question. And it's a huge question. But at least that is that can be tested and verified.
Okay, let's go to the phones, because that's what they're waiting for. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi. I just wanted to ask if either of the guests had ever thought about the Sky Ground Plan extending off of the Giza Plateau, maybe into the village across the street from the sink.
Or is anybody familiar with that? You're crackling up on us, so I had
to put you on. I couldn't hear what she was saying.
No, I know what she's talking
about.
Okay,
go ahead, Robert.
And I think it definitely extends beyond the Giza Plateau itself. What I believe the caller's referring to is the Giza Sky Plan, the concept that the three main pyramids are the Belt of Orion.
Oh, I see.
And mapping, basically you're mapping stars in the sky on the Giza Plateau. And, yes, I think that extends both north and south of the plateau, maybe going up into the Saqqara Plateau, the Dashur, et cetera, and also probably extends into the village. We know for certain that there are a lot of antiquities, a lot of sites that are now covered over by the suburbs of Cairo to the east of the Giza Plateau. And getting back to Zahi, actually one thing that he wants to do and is working on potentially instituting is moving out some of the villagers, giving them property elsewhere. And he wants to uncover some of the archaeological sites.
How close do people live to the pyramid structure?
Stone's throw, literally.
Really?
Yes, yes. It most people don't realize this, because if you have certain pictures of the Giza Plateau from certain angles, or say from the west, it looks like it's just all desert. In fact, it is on the edge of the Sahara Desert. But as Chris well knows, on the other side, east of the eastern side of the plateau, right in front of the Sphinx, there's the suburbs of Cairo, basically, are there.
Yeah, there's a huge village
complex
at the right near the Sphinx that is heavily populated.
What a view when you wake up in the morning, looking out your back window.
Oh, yeah, exactly. You can stay at the Mina House Hotel and look out the window and see the pyramids. And from the Mina House, you can simply walk to the plateau very easily.
West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Yeah, hi. This is Francesco in Hayford, California.
Francesco, welcome to the show.
Great to talk to you guys. I'm calling in regards of a ram pump theory I stumbled upon a couple of years ago. Kind of been in the back of my mind, but
Edward
actually,
Kunkel.
What's that?
Edward Kunkel.
Is that? I think. Yeah. I actually built one of these ram pumps, and there was a link on this website, and it seemed fascinating how the inside, you know, basically added up to be one of these pumps. I guess whoever's not aware of what a ram pump is, it pumps water up to higher ground with water as the power. And I'm wondering what you guys think of that. I believe it was the pyramid of Cheops, however you say that?
Yeah, the Khufu pyramid or Cheops.
Okay, Cheops. Mm-hmm. So what do you guys think of that?
I'll let Chris go first.
Sure.
Okay. I heard that theory back in the 70s when I first started to do my research. And I pretty much dismissed it because of the nature of the of the construction. And basically my feelings are that if you were going to pump water up that high, you wouldn't need a structure that covers 13 acres like that. And so it was there's a lot of redundant masonry involved in this. Now, since then, I've been in communication with a gentleman by the name of John Cadman, and he contacted me and claimed that he had tried to test Kunkel's theory. And he's a maritime engineer, and he was very, very interested in Kunkel's theory. And he found that he couldn't get it to work quite the way Kunkel described it would work. But he was seemingly impressed with my book, and he tried to impress me that the combination of hydraulics and what I presented in my book combined would work, because in my book I theorized that in the subterranean chamber was a mechanism for driving the pyramid to resonance. And he actually replicated the lower parts of the Great Pyramid, the descending passage and the subterranean chamber. His model, though, includes other shafts leading off from the chamber. However, he finally got my attention, and I flew out to Washington State, where he lives, in Bellingham, Washington, and he lives on the side of this hillside, and he had a catch pond with water filled, and he had the water coming down to a mechanism and a model of the subterranean chamber. And it was a very interesting story that he would get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. He was kind of like, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Fourth Kind, when the guy was piling up mashed potatoes in his living room. Well, he was getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning, inspired, and he would be carving on this model of the subterranean chamber. Well, to cut a long story short, I flew out there to witness a demonstration, and accompanying. Actually, it wasn't accompanying me. I met him there also. It was a hydraulics engineer, Dr. Jack Cole, because he was there to witness it also. Well, something really, really interesting. He turned a simple valve. He turned the valve on to let the water flow. He allowed it to pump up to and release the air. And then he shut another valve off so that it would not be flowing vertically, but going down to a wastegate. Uh-huh. And the ground started to shake. And it actually had a beat. I timed the beat. It was 60 cycles per second.
Huh.
But the beat was quite interesting, because it wasn't just a regular rhythm like one, two, three, four. It beat like a heart.
Huh. From the water hammer.
Lub-dub. And I looked at Dr. Cole, and he looked at me, and I said, "Well, Dr. Cole, what's causing the heartbeat?" And he threw his arms up in the air, and he says, "I have no idea." But his replica was actually modeled after the subterranean chamber.
All right, thank you. Go ahead. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello, George.
Yeah.
Hey. This is Joe from Columbus, Ohio. I was kind of curious if anybody's ever had the theory that since it was so long ago, like over 10,000 years ago or whatever, if anybody's having the theory that maybe gravity wasn't as great back at that time, that maybe over time the gravity's increased. I mean, that maybe that's how they put the blocks.
So it was easier to move the blocks?
Right.
What do you think? Who wants that?
Robert, you could take that one.
Well, I've certainly heard that theory many times. That's the type of thing that would be very difficult to test on the one level. On another level, it really gets into a lot of complications, because if gravity were that perceptibly lower, if it were that different than it is now, you would expect changes in organisms,
True. They'd be bigger. Well, you know, there's talk, though, we had giants, Robert, on this planet. Yeah,
that's, and that ties in with that, and how good is that evidence, that type of thing. I'm not saying it's something we can't consider, but it has a lot of ramifications that would have to be thought through.
Christopher, what about your thigh? We talked about Edward Leeds Scanlon and the possibilities of how they move those stones. Do you think it was that some kind of technology beyond what people have said in the past, and that would be pulleys and ramps?
Yes, I think that it was something greater than pulleys and ramps. My hunch is that they were able to manipulate gravity in some way and lift those huge stones. When you look at the size of these blocks, they weigh 400, 1,000 ton statues, and the Ramses statues at Luxor, they're absolutely incredible. And they were able to move these huge objects and maintain, either they carved them with precision in place or they maintained the precision on the objects when they were moving them. So I think they definitely had something that we have yet to discover.
What about Margaret's theories that they can't find any quarries where some of these huge blocks would have come from?
Robert?
Oh, well, I think there are a couple of issues there. I'm not sure that, to be honest, I'm not sure that her argument along those lines is valid. There are a number of quarries. We have not mapped all the quarries. A lot of quarries are basically sanded in at this point, and we don't know their full extent. Also, it's a matter, the theory of poured blocks does not negate the concept of quarries. You still have to quarry that material somewhere, even if you're quarrying it as aggregate to make essentially concrete.
Then my old extraterrestrial theory would be that they were cut out somewhere and basically beamed over.
Well, beamed over is one thing, but actually I think we should go back to the water pump theory just for a second.
Because
sure. Something that Kunkel, okay, let me make two quick comments. I'm not convinced that the Great Pyramid was a water pump. I do think that you could potentially retrofit parts of it to turn it into a water pump. It just has that type of geometry. One of the big concerns I have, from what I understand of the water pump theory, is how you would get excess water out of the subterranean chamber once it's down there. I've been in the subterranean chamber a number of times, have explored all the passages that lead off of it, and at this point I'm not convinced there's any good way to get the excess water out of it. But getting back to Kunkel, who came up with the water pump theory, something he also promoted in his work was that the Egyptians were overcoming gravity, if you would, by using barges and docks, essentially canals, artificial canals, and then building docks, the basic procedure that's used to move huge ships up and down vertically. Now, I'm not advocating that personally, but I do think it's an interesting proposal, if not for the pyramids, maybe for some of the other temples where they're using some kind of dock system. I'm sorry, did I say dock? Lock.
An interlocking system.
Locks where you have canals, like, and you have locks, and you can move to higher elevations.
Exactly. Let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air with us. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, thank you.
My name is Michael. I'm in Albany.
New York. Sure.
Yes. What I have had an experience from time to time on doing healings, that there are some negative things that come through on film. And I'm wondering what sort of dark side technology you might be opening up, and what will become as a result, you know? So I'm wondering, do you know that in some case you might be opening up a can of worms?
Well, who wants that?
No, I'm not sure what the question was.
Well, I think I understand the question. If you
go ahead.
As far as if we do research on new technologies, what kind of ramifications are associated with them, such as the development of nuclear power. There were negative and positive ramifications. I see that any kind of technology or any of our endeavors have both positive and negative to them. As far as the Great Pyramid, as I theorize it, I see a lot of positive aspects to it if it is used properly, and that is the harmonizing of the plates and the harmonizing of the people, and while at the same time generating energy. I know it's very, very radical and far-fetched idea, but that is basically what I have come to understand through my research.
I believe there was someone that had some music that they sold that were guests here at the George Noory Show. And that had some very dimensional effect of opening up a person to different dimensions. Are you aware of that?
Yes. I've heard of the stories associated with the Great Pyramid regarding how it affects people who spend some time within the King's Chamber or even inside the so-called sarcophagus. There are some significant effects associated with it. And until you actually experience it, it's easy to just dismiss it. But there are particular energies associated with the Great Pyramid, and it can have an effect. It can be very uplifting, or it could strike the fear of God in you, as it has some researchers, visitors like Napoleon, who spent some time in the Great Pyramid, came out white as a sheet, and refused to go back in.
Okay, well, hold on. We'll be back with final phone calls, final comments in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, it'll be our final segment with final calls, but first, Christopher Dunn, what's on your plate in the future here with your research?
Oh, thanks for asking. I'm actually heading back to Egypt on February the 15th. I'll be spending a couple of nights in London going to the British Museum, but I'm heading over with my co-author, Edward Malkowski, and we're going to spend a couple of weeks there. So, and then we're collaborating on a book which should be scheduled for publication 2008.
Excellent. And how about you, Robert?
I continue to work in Egypt with the Great Pyramid and the other pyramids. And something that actually bears on the last question that we have had before the break is, now that I understand it, sort of what I would call the spiritual aspects of ancient Egypt, and I have become very interested in what exactly was going on with the pyramids, with the temples, and I believe much of it was sort of spiritual or sacred, or to use sort of different phraseology, psychical or paranormal. And so I've become very interested in those aspects. And this is something I think we find in all the sacred sites, or most of the sacred sites around the world, that there's a reason for them being built, and exactly where they were built also. It's not just random. It's not just arbitrary. And I'd also like to make the point, and this ties in with my own research and the discussion we had just before the break, one reason, in my opinion, to study Egypt is that we have in Egypt a civilization that, yes, it had its ups and downs, but it had continuity and a stability going that lasted for thousands of years, and I think that's really something that we can learn from, what exactly was going on with the civilization that could have that continuity and relative stability for thousands of years. We look at our own civilizations, and they come and go in the blink of an eye compared to ancient Egypt.
All right, let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello. Are you aware that there's a Pythagorean triangle that's been polished into the basement stone in the so-called King's Chamber? It's also bisected in the golden section.
You too?
Yes, I believe that Peter Tompkins addressed that in his book, The Secrets of the Great Pyramid. I haven't actually done the measures myself.
Well, no, but do you know the phi proportion?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And the, well, those two, where the Sphinx, the Leo, you know, the hindquarters of the Sphinx and the face of the Sphinx is bisected in the same golden section in the constellations of Leo and Virgo.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, then are you aware of Philadelphius and Philae?
Well, what's the significance, though, sir, of all this stuff?
Well, the sacred proportions that are included in all of the, like at Karnak, the great pylon of Pi.
Right, right. They're incorporated into all these structures, and this is actually gets into, in my opinion, the work of Shuar de Lubitsch, who demonstrated this very specifically and with incredible measurements in his monographic studies, particularly of the Temple of Luxor, what he refers to as the Temple of Man.
Who do you think might have been the architect of these structures? Because whoever it was understood geometry and a lot of things.
I personally don't think it was a single individual. I think that you had actually a school. Some people nowadays might phrase it in terms of secret society or initiates, but I think it was knowledge and that was developed and passed on from generation to generation. You look at something like the temple at Luxor, and we know very clearly, it's well documented that temple was not all of one piece. It was built and rebuilt, and the axes, in fact, were shifted slightly over time, which has to do with stellar alignments. But it was built and rebuilt, but these harmonies and proportions and this continuity was maintained.
Okay, let's go west of the Rockies. You're up on Coast to Coast with us. Hello there.
George?
Yes.
George, name's Moy. Dearborn, Michigan. Just want to say you're my idol.
You didn't own a restaurant, did you?
No, I did not.
All right.
No, I did not. Moy from Michigan. I just want to let your guests know. I was at the Coral Castle in Florida. One of the, I guess, the coordinators or the guides brought me and two other guys. He wanted to prove a point. He put me in the middle of a certain point in the Coral Castle, had the two other gentlemen, well, he had me stretch out my arms, had each guy on each side put their hands on my hand and told them to push my hands down with all their force, and I was to hold my force up. And the first time they did it, I just dropped. These guys were big guys. I'm only 5'7". These guys were about 6 foot. Then he said, okay, guys, step aside. He went to a certain end of the castle there, moved a certain rock, turned the rock in my direction, told the same guys to do the same thing with my arm straight up. These guys were big. They could not move my arms down. I had my arms straight up it was like nothing. They put all their force in. They could not move my hands down. It was quite amazing.
Well, there's no question that whatever was going on at Coral Castle, as we talked about earlier, Christopher, that guy knew. Ed Lead Skolnin knew what was going on.
Yeah, he had something that he wanted to protect, and unfortunately, he took it to his grave with him.
Sure did. Next up, east of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there. Hello? Well, he is gone. Let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, good morning.
Yeah.
Or actually, good evening, I guess, where I'm at. Truck driver, long-time listeners, about 20 years or better. I have a question. How do they know they've discovered all the chambers? Is there a way to go through the stone and everything and, you know, like x-ray it or whatever?
Well, I would say the short answer is we don't know. In fact, there's a lot of speculation that there may be other chambers in the Great Pyramid. The empty space, the void, the chambers, the passages that we know about in the Great Pyramid are a very, very, very small percentage of the volume of the Great Pyramid. So, in my opinion, there is a possibility of finding more. Now, there have been some remote studies done trying to locate chambers, and they have not been universally agreed upon as being successful in finding anything. What I mean by that is that so far, the studies I've seen, nothing was found, but that doesn't necessarily preclude that there could be something, because there have been questions about the techniques used.
See, and
they would have necessarily found everything.
And the port theory doesn't really address the chambers, does it? I don't think it does.
No, I don't think it does either, personally.
Picking up on what you said, Robert, on the exploration.
Go ahead, Christopher.
Yeah.
May I speak?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. The exploration of the southern shaft and the northern shaft, where they drilled through the plate and the southern shaft and they found a small space behind it. When they went up the northern shaft, they found the same, almost the same situation, where there were two fittings or metal fittings coming out from the limestone and down. And as you know, George, I was on your show before that exploration, and
right,
I had a prediction of what they would find. Unfortunately, the camera did not look behind, and the lighting was not that revealing, but it certainly did not negate the prediction that I had put out there, and also wrote about in my book. And so anyway, I just thought I would throw that in.
Right. I was going to say another possibility for finding directly other chambers and cavities is through, for instance, the grotto, which is Chris knows what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
If you go down the so-called well shaft from the base of the Grand Gallery into what's known as the grotto, which is essentially filled with rubble and has never, to my knowledge, been excavated.
Yeah. And I haven't been down there. Have you been down there, Robert?
No, I have not. I don't know anyone who's been down there. It's been closed off by the Egyptians for the last century, apparently.
Okay, first-time caller line, welcome to the program. You're on the air with us with Robert Schock and Christopher Dunn.
How you doing?
Good. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, I was wondering if you had, between the four of you, any of your books on CD. And I was wondering about the religion part. Was it, you think the pyramids were ever flooded by the 40 days and 40 nights rain?
I don't have any books on CD, and I don't really have a... I'm not a religious Bible scholar, so...
No, I'm not a religious Bible scholar either, and I don't have anything on CD, although various programs, a lecture that I gave actually in October, this past October, I think it was, is on CD. That's available.
Robert, there's no doubt that the Sphinx has some incredible water erosion.
It does have incredible water erosion, and what I believe that's from, I'll be agnostic on the biblical flood at the moment. What the water erosion on the Sphinx is from, in my interpretation, my analysis, is actually from precipitation, so that's not incompatible with those that believe in the flood, and that came from rainwater. But you've got incredible amounts of precipitation causing the erosion and weathering on the Sphinx and the Sphinx enclosure. And I think that was taking place over a considerable period of time. But that period of time was before the modern Sahara was the Sahara Desert. So that's part of the story of how it places it well back in time, well back into pre-dynastic times.
Well, you know, I think about 20,000 years ago, I think that whole region was pretty lush.
Oh, yes, 20,000 years ago, absolutely it was.
We
also know that for the last 5,000 years, it's been absolute desert,
yeah,
much desert, and that's not compatible with the Sphinx having been built or carved initially 2500 BC, 4,500 years ago, because at 4,500 years ago, it was desert, and it's been desert ever since.
I remember a picture that I saw in high school when they were looking for parts of the Sphinx, and they uncovered it, and, you know, it was almost like just the head was above the sand, right?
Oh, yeah.
Originally?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, in the 19th century, early 19th century, it was only the head sticking out of the sand, and to this day, if the plateau were just deserted, wait a couple of centuries, I'm sure it would all fill in with sand again, and only the head would stick out.
You know, Robert, if they ever open up that chamber that you probably have found, Edgar Cayce always said that included in there was the Hall of Records of All Mankind, teaching us the secrets of things.
Now, that would be something.
Oh, my gosh.
That would be incredible.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Hello.
I really find your talk on pyramids really fascinating, and I hope if you ever go there, since your roots is in Cairo, I would really love to go on a trip. I'd love to see the inside of them.
Maybe we'll do a coast-to-coast trip, huh? And
we need to do that.
Christopher and Robert together.
You guys are so
interesting. Pull that off.
So interesting. Like, just that last part about, you know, because, you know, the uncovered and the secrets like Edgar Cayce. It's very, very fascinating. Well, I just wanted to tell a story that my uncle used to tell many times, and I never could really understand it, but, you know, from listening to your show and the people on it and also Coral Castle, when he was a young boy, him and his cousins, they said they were jumping on these big rocks. They're like big boulders. And one of his cousins jumped on this big one, and it threw him right off. I mean, it literally right threw him. And they left. They never went back. But I still think now, from what I've learned, there's got to be a place where these rocks are coming from. And I think you're right, like Ed, he did know how to use them and how to, you know, navigate them. Like, there just has to be a place where they're still around.
Christopher,
am I out of my world here when I say that?
No, not at all.
No.
Not at all. Christopher, who do you think taught Lead Skalden these secrets?
I think he probably worked on his own intuition. And
maybe he was reincarnated from the Egyptian days.
Yeah.
You never know.
Another Nikola Tesla.
Yeah, exactly. Couple more calls, and then we are done. East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Gary.
Hi, Gary. Where are you calling from?
Oh, I'm calling from beautiful downtown Des Moines, Iowa.
Wonderful. Go ahead.
Yes, I want to, you know, I'll just say what I got to say and listen over to you. Why don't you guys specialists in all this pyramid stuff and astrology and astronomy, why don't you check the Vatican out there, you know, observatory, why do they have it over there in Rome? And what's the big secret about Coral Castle? Why don't somebody take a big study on this guy? You know, where was he educated in? Is this all one big cover-up, like the government is covering up UFOs?
Well, as Leedskalna came from Eastern Europe.
He came from Latvia.
Yeah.
And his background was in masonry and logging.
What it is interesting that not a lot of people are doing a lot of research into him or how that was built. I guess, you know what? Pure science doesn't chase that, does it?
No, I mean, that actually gets back to something we talked about earlier, the problem of funding and, you know, it takes money. I hate to say it that way.
It does take money.
It takes money, and you know, when you have to do a full-time job otherwise and you do these things on the side,
right,
it's difficult.
Christopher, we're out of time. Robert, we're going to get you back for another show as well on the Sphinx. We've got to do that one. That's an incredible show. Both of you, thank you for being on Coast to Coast.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Very enjoyable.
And everybody's websites, all four guests that were on tonight are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And if you haven't had the opportunity to go to those sites, do that, because you're missing out on some great information. They all have their own theories, their thoughts on how the Great Pyramid was built. I bet you have yours, and I have mine. I sometimes think that they were helped from above. Might be right. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.